drove over the road, highway, and camped along the way.
Yeah.
My, but it was real exciting. Even the girls ran the canyons.
Is that right?
Yeah, three of the girls ran the Keystone Canyon.
Really?
Yes, and those
oh
guys.
My gosh.
And one of them, who was not as experienced, you know, they turn over and do these Eskimo rolls.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of them lost her paddle on that Eskimo roll. Well, then she was helpless, you know. So she just left her kayak and swam ashore. It's a good thing she was a strong swimmer.
Out of the Keystone Canyon?
Yeah, right in the Keystone Canyon.
Holy smoke, that's swift in there.
And, you know, the photographers had been complaining. They said, well, those fellas have such mastery over the rivers that it doesn't look exciting. So they got them to ham it up, you know, and do a lot of extra stuff to make it look dangerous.
What were they being photographed for?
Well, it's a film for some kayak company.
I see.
And kayaking has got very popular outside now.
Mm-hmm.
And the oldest Spencer boy is a kayak guide. There's parties come up here just for kayaking in the summertime, and he guides them.
Yeah. Huh. What a wonderful summer occupation.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Well, to get back to your camp, your camping, and you're cooking at a camp, what kind of bread did you make? Did you just have rolls, or just one, just plain old white bread all the time, or did you have a variety?
I had white bread and whole wheat bread.
You make breakfast rolls?
No.
Any fancy cooking?
No. Plain camp cooking.
Yeah.
Plain camp cooking, but we had pies and cakes all the time.
Mm-hmm. And you say the people who went, whom you guided, paid for and expected the best.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you have any peculiar requests for food? Any specific items requested
yes,
by some of the?
Yes, we did. We had a rich old Jewish fellow that came. He came two different times, and his father was a rabbi. And he wanted everything kosher. He couldn't have any bacon or anything like mm-hmm. that. He didn't want anything fried or cooked in bacon grease. It had to be butter. And a lot of his things had to be cooked separate from the rest of them.
I see.
And then we had a couple from about the time that Huey Long was lording it over the South. A couple of his henchmen came up here on a hunt. And they came with an aristocratic old gentleman that had been up here several times before, but they had twisted his arm to get in on the hunt. I gathered from him, he didn't say so in so many words, but I gathered from him that he'd been forced into bringing them along, although he didn't want to.
Yeah.
And they liked this Louisiana hot sauce.
Uh-oh.
And I would have a pot roast on the stove, and I remember one of them came in and he took his old dirty bloody skin a knife off of his belt and socked it down into that roast here and there and poured this, they brought their own hot sauce with them, and poured a whole bottle of hot sauce into that roast, ruined the whole roast so nobody else could eat it.
Oh my gosh.
So I gave the rest of the people chops or something that I, and just gave him the roast. No one else could eat that hot sauce he had.
That was a thing.
Yeah.
Not a very, that was kind of a selfish thing to do, I'd
Yeah,
say.
It was. Well, they were like that, those two.
Yeah.
Well, they were like that, those two. And when they first came, they just considered us the servants, the guides and the packers and the cook. We were just the crew. We were servants. And they started to put us in our place. Well, we sure put them in their place. Leave it to Alaskans.
Yeah. Yeah, when you're out on the hunt like that, you all pitch in, whether you're guest or
That's
client
right.
or
yeah.
or guide. Any of during these years that you and your husband guided together, you went with him. Did you ever have any accidents, or did any of the clients have any accidents with guns, weapons, or fall down a cliff? Any problems in that area?
No, not on the hunting trips, but out of the lodge, they had kind of a scare one time. When Cecil Rhode first started to take movies of brown bears for his lecture course, Luke went with him and backed him up with a rifle, because brown bears are unpredictable. You can't tell whether they're gonna charge or not, and especially if you go after them on their feeding grounds, you're apt to get charged. So we had other guests at the lodge, and Cecil was there, and Cecil and Luke had gone to the upper river and taken movies of brown bears fishing for salmon up there. And they came back and told about it. And there was a retired colonel and his wife who were guests at the lodge. And right away the colonel wanted to go up there and take movies too. Well, his wife started to yell about it because he had a heart condition and she didn't think he ought to do it. And the boys tried to put him off, you know, and they put him off a day or two, and finally he just insisted, and they finally had to take him. So they took him up, and it was all grown up with high grass along there, and the bear trails were going through it, and they were going up the river through the bear trail, and they could hear the bears splashing, you know, chasing the salmon up above in the river. And the colonel got so excited he had a heart attack. He fell down right in the middle of the muddy trail right on top of a dead salmon. And and the boys had a time, you know, trying to resuscitate him. And when he came to, he made so much noise, moaning and groaning, they scared all the bears away. He made more noise than the bears. And they had a time getting him home, but the bears were gone, so they went down and got the boat or the canoe or whatever they had, and waded up the stream with it and got him in the boat and got him home. So that was the only a bad attack that we ever had on any of the hunts.
The only accident, well, it's really, I guess you could call it an accident.
Uh-huh.
Well, did you ever have to shoot a bear yourself in self-protection?
Oh, yes. I didn't shoot him self-protection, shy because I wanted to.
For a trophy?
Yeah, that was up in the Cache Creek District years ago.
Mm-hmm. Was he bothering your camp? Or?
No. No, he was in a berry patch. I was at the mining camps at the time, and I was way up high on a hillside picking low bush blueberries. And I looked at my watch, and it was time to go home and get supper. And I started down the trail, and in the berry patch below me, a great big brownie raised up. And he stood up on his hind legs and looked, and then he just went down again in the brush, hidden, you know. And I had to go along that trail right square through that berry patch. And I wasn't about to walk in on top of him. And I sat down and waited and waited. He didn't show up anymore. He never showed up. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to get him out of there. I got to go home and get supper. So I fired a couple shots with my rifle. And he stood up this way again, you know, to look, see what it was all about. And I caught him, got him right in here. And he flopped down again, you know, and rolled in the bushes, thrashed around. And he stood up again. I give him another. And that time, he was so near the edge. This berry patch was, you know, was on a narrow place. Cliffs here and a big canyon down below. Uh-huh. And he rolled over into the canyon.
Oh.
And, that canyon was just chock full of brush, and all the old timers had impressed on me, never go into the brush after a wounded bear. And I waited and waited, and he didn't come up and didn't show up. And I thought, well, if I go down in there, I'm either going to get clobbered or else I'll catch the devil for going down in there. Mm-hmm. And so I went on home and told the boys that I shot the bear and he'd roll down in the brush and they'd have to come up and help me get him. Well, this was real late in the fall, you know, and the clouds were pretty ominous blowing in around the mountaintops, and they wouldn't go until after they got their dinner that night. And by the time we got up the mountain, it was starting to get dark, and it started to snow. And it just snowed gallons, you know, just, you've seen it come down on the mountaintop where it's just a whiteout, tons of snow coming down. Well, we looked all around down in there. We couldn't find anything. Of course, the snow had covered all the tracks by then. And so it got dark, and we had to get out of there. So I never did get him. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure I got him. He rolled down in there. But when the snow comes in the mining camp, you shut up camp and leave the next morning. And that's what they did. And nobody would go with me to look for the bear anymore. And everyone was moving out. So we had to pack up and move out. So I never did get that hide.
Yeah.
That's the only one I shot by myself, but I've helped shoot others, but you know, on trips.
Hunt.
Where,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did Luke ever have to shoot a bear? Was he ever attacked by one or surprised by one?
Oh, well, he's had hunters where they, where the bears charged.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to finish him off.
Any real close calls?
No. You have a
just
high
a
power.
Good shot.
Yeah, you have a high power rifle. You can pretty well stop them.
Yeah.
Although, there was a guy who got killed up in the interior, wasn't there, by a bear. Remember about that?
I'm trying to think who that was.
I can't recall his name.
There've been several bear kills, you know, in the last 10, 15 years,
yeah.
But.
But the guy and Nana both got killed on that trip.
Yeah.
I remember that. I can't recall his name.
I can't either.
But they poked the bear out of his den in the spring.
Yeah.
That's kind of dangerous business.
Yeah, you betcha.
Yeah.
I just can't, right now, I know the incident, but I can't recall the place or the name. But that doesn't concern your...
No.
Your story.
No.
So it was about 1958 then that you sold your lodge, and then did you move into Anchorage at that time, or?
Well, we came in just till we settled up our affairs. Then we went on to Hawaii.
Then that's when you started this 10 years of traveling around.
Yeah, that's right.
And when did your husband pass away?
It was, when was it? 69. 69,
you traveled 10 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
69.
Yeah.
Were you here during the big earthquake here in Anchorage?
No. We were in Hawaii that winter. And we had reservations to come home that week of the earthquake. And, you know, they had a tidal wave in Hawaii, which was caused by the earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an alert, and everybody had to get out of town that had cars. And if you couldn't get a taxi, you had to go up on top of one of the big skyscrapers and spend the night. And that's what we did. We were up on the top of a skyscraper. And I had a little portable radio with me. And the people were following me around listening to it. And we just couldn't believe it when we heard what was happening in Alaska. We just simply couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, there was some damage in Hawaii. We could look down on the Alawai Canal, and all the water was drained out of the canal, and the fish were flopping in the mud on the bottom of it. And then it all came back in, and went out and came in several times. And the water got into the yacht club, I think, down on the waterfront, but there was really no damage.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a big scare.
Yeah.
But the year or so before that, a big tidal wave had just about wiped out Hilo over on the Big Island, so there was plenty of cause to be alarmed.
Yes. Was that from an earthquake in the Aleutians?
No, I think
Japan?
It was in Chile. I think it was the Chile. Earthquake in Chile that wiped out Hilo.
Yeah. When you would spend the winters then in Hawaii or Mexico?
Yeah.
When you weren't traveling.
That's right.
And then when you came back to Alaska, did you live here in Anchorage during the summer?
No.
Months,
no, we always went to Kenai Lake to be amongst our old friends and
yeah.
rented whatever cabin was empty and available down there.
I see.
So we lived at Kenai Lake in the summers.
Are there some real old timers down in the Kenai Lake area still?
Well, most of the old ones are all gone.
Mm-hmm.
Jacqueline is at Sitka, the home at Sitka.
Jack Lane?
He's one of the early old-timers. He and his brother Charlie Lane were two of the old-timers there from way back when.
Well, what'd they do? Mine or guide or
yeah,
trap?
Yeah, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Hunt, whatnot. And Burl Lane, who was the wife of Charlie, is now living in Juneau in Douglas, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
She's one of the old-timers from way back when.
Is Charlie dead?
No, he's dead. Charlie Lane is dead.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Toll is dead. He was one of the old-timers there. And Dunk Little is dead. He was another old-timer who lived there.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, there's no old timers there anymore.
When you went into Seward in 1920, were there some real old timers living there? People who had come up for the gold rush?
Yes.
The Nome Rush and the Klondike?
Yeah. I can tell you about one that we used to go visit. They called him Pap Taylor. He had a little cabin on the outskirts of town. And he had a great, huge dog. He looked like he was part Great Dane or something. And the dog would stand up. It put his paws on the man's shoulders, and he was taller than the man by far. And we asked Pap, where on earth he got that dog? He said, well, it was a descendant of a dog he had up at Nome in the early days. And he said when they went to Nome, they were mining on the beach, and he said they were Cheechakers, and they didn't know any better than to build their cabin right up against the bluffs on the beach. And the prevailing wind came blowing out over the land and kept drifting the snow deeper and deeper over their cabin, and they kept putting on more and more lakes of stovepipe until they got to the tops of the bluffs with it. And said then they had so much snow to dig in and out every morning, said they couldn't get out of their cabin because the snow had all drifted overnight. And but they said they hit on the idea of taking the dog in the house with them. And then the door opened in, and they opened the door, and they sick the dog onto something out there, just act like there was something terrible out there. And they'd sick the dog, and he'd start digging and barking and digging. Pretty soon he'd dig a tunnel through for him. So that's the way they got in and out. And this dog that Pap had down there at Seward was, you know, this is the dog that had pups and so on and so on. And this was
a descendant of
that one that used to dig the tunnel for him.
That's interesting. I never thought of animals as descendants of the gold rush. I wonder if there are any... Do you know of any other dogs that are animals that might be descended from animals that came over the trail?
I don't.
I imagine there might be some.
Oh, yeah.
Probably some of the Eskimo dogs up in the Arctic. Of course, they're mostly all gone now. But they were... When I went to Barrow in 1950, we had the most gosh-awful looking sled dogs. And it was interesting. We'd sit back and speculate about, wonder what kind of dog that dog's mother was and father. And some were obviously mixture sheepdog, and you could see strains of St. Bernard in some. Pathetic animals. The Eskimos didn't have enough to feed them. It was terribly pathetic. Mm. So those starving animals.
Well, when we were up in Cache Creek mining, we had a team of Siberians. We raised them ourselves, and that was a nice little team. Mm. And the leader was quite a character. He was an old leader, and the rest of the team was pups. And this old leader had been given to me. There was a miner that came in and out of the district that was real mean to his dogs, real cruel to them. And everybody, you know, was mad at him about it. And then he would bring the dog team in and haul in all his freight and treat them mean. And then he wouldn't feed them over summer. He'd kill them all and get another team. And this particular dog, this other old miner that lived close to him, asked for this dog for company because he's going off prospecting corner of the woods where there was that no one had been, and he wanted company. So he took this dog with him and went out there. And the dog was used to being in a big team. He got lonesome too. He'd run away and go back to the settlement. Well, they'd think, well, Henry's dead. Here's the dog, come back without him. Then they'd send out a search party to try to find Henry. And and Henry always claimed that Rats was the dog's name. He claimed that Rats could read. He said he'd go in the tent where he kept his supplies, and he'd steal a can that had meat in it, or fish, and he'd take it out and bury it in the woods. And then when he wanted it, he'd gnaw it open and eat it. And he never took anything but meat or fish. He said he could read the labels.
Yeah.
Well, naturally, the dog could smell it, you know.
Yeah.
So Henry got mad at the dog because he wouldn't stay with him. And so he gave him to me. And he was the funniest dog. He wouldn't eat when you were looking at him. You know, he had a big scar across his nose where his first owner had hit him with an axe across the nose.
Mm.
Excuse me.
How can people be so cruel to animals?
Oh, I don't know. Some people just got that streak of cruelty in them. I've seen them. I've known people like that. Well, anyway, I couldn't do anything with rats. He was so shy, and you couldn't take a picture of him. You know, if you pointed a camera at him, he'd just crawl up inside himself almost.
Yeah.
And if you took him his feed, he wouldn't eat it till he went away. And so after Luke got this team of pups, he started trying to make a leader out of him. And all the other fellas said, oh, you'll never make a leader out of that dog, never, no, in this wide world. But you know, Luke worked with him till he did make a leader out of him. And we had this team of pups there, when they were pups. We had this old dog, and then we bought all this team to raise, we bought these pups to raise for a team. Mm-hmm. And we had them a long ways off from the old dog because we knew he was old and crabby and snappy, and we didn't want him to hurt the pups. Well, one day I was busy in the cabin and I heard the funniest noise, kind of a coaxing noise, you know, and I looked out to see what it was, and he had coaxed the pups up around him. He was on the end of his chain, and he coaxed the pups over there, and they were sitting all around, a half circle around him. And he was talking to them, you know, and bouncing and trying to play with them. And I thought, why, that old devil, he's going to coax them up and bite them. Pardon me. And I went out and chased the pups all back to where they belonged. But you know, he kept doing that until he got made friends with those pups.
Yeah.
Well, then he made a good leader for the team.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Luke made a wonderful...
Poor dog. He probably had such a miserable life and mistreated that it was the first real...
Friends he'd ever
real
had.
Real friends he'd ever had.
Yeah. And he turned into a wonderful leader.
Good.
He'd just do anything that Luke told him. And
that's great.
I told you he wouldn't eat until he went away. But after Luke got to working with him, one day he took his feed out and set it down in front of him and started to go away, and the dog stuck out his paw to shake hands. He'd been taught that someplace way back when.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
So Luke shook hands with him, and after that they were, the dog just adored Luke.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't have anything to do with me. When I hitched up the team to go, I had to have a fight with that dog every time to let him know who was boss.
Yeah.
Didn't want to have anything to do with women.
Yeah.
But he just adored Luke.
Yeah.
And he was a wonderful leader.
What did you use your team for? Just mostly transportation or for freighting?
Hauling in the freight for the mining camps.
Mm-hmm.
We had 8 claims up on Peters Creek, which
and
is...
How far was it? You hauled it from where, the railroad?
Talkeetna.
Talkeetna.
It was a 60-mile haul.
60 miles.
Yeah. And rats, this old leader, I think, saved our life one time. You know, you don't start out in soft weather if you can help it with a dog team with a heavy load. But sometimes you get caught in it, you know, when a monsoon or something comes and it changes suddenly.
Right.
So one time we were coming with freight, and below our camp there was a 3-mile canyon. And the trail went through the canyon. And, you know, the snow slopes down this way. And you take a shovel, you know, and dig out the trail, a dog team trail around it. And the water was so swift in there that it never froze in the winter. There were whirlpools and rapids in there. And it never did freeze in the winter, no matter how far below zero it was. Well, every time after you went over that trail, the wind would get up, the wind through a canyon, you know, like a funnel. And the trails would drift shut, and then you'd have to dig them all out again when you wanted to go over them again. Well, we were going home with a load, and we got into that canyon, and the weather changed. And the snow all softened, you know, and it stuck on the, all over the sled, and it stuck all over the dog's feet, and just like a big snowball. And we couldn't get any farther, and Luke just unhooked the dogs and left the sled there in the trail. And we started up the canyon with just the dog team. He was hanging on to the end of the tow rope, and the dogs were going ahead. And there was a whiteout. It was snowing so hard that we couldn't see the dog ahead of us. We couldn't see the lead dog. Luke was hanging on to the tow rope, and I was hanging on to the tail of his parkie. And he said, don't let loose. And we were going up through the canyon, and we heard the water swirling down, and you could pretty well hear,
yeah,
even though it was a whiteout. And Luke was jeeing and hawing the dogs around where he thought they ought to go. And we got up about the middle of the canyon, and he yelled G at them, and they went G. And rats always obeyed him. He never disobeyed. But the next thing, we found ourselves being dragged right up the side of that canyon. And I wouldn't let loose, Luke wouldn't let loose, and the dogs just clawed their way up the side of that canyon until we came out on top. And we come to find out a snowslide had just slicked the whole snowslide and come down and just slicked all the crags and everything down into the water. And if we'd have gone, if we'd gone ahead the way we had wanted to, we'd have gone into that whirlpool.
And holy smoke.
That'd been the last of us.
Yeah.
So we figured the old leader had saved the life.
He knew what he was doing.
Uh-huh. He knew what he was doing. We didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Holy smoke.
Yeah.
Well, you can be grateful to that dog.
Yes.
Yeah. That's wonderful to have an animal like that.
Yeah. And Luke figured he saved his life one time before, or else a bad mix-up. One time out of Seward, this Gus Gellis was at, which I told you had organized the guides one time.
Yeah.
He was also a traveling salesman. And he got into Seward with his luggage, his traveling salesman luggage. And there was no train over to Anchorage. So he came to Luke and wanted Luke to take him over with the dog team. So they set out. Well, they always used to travel the railroad tracks out of Seward with the dog teams because, you know, it had been plowed and was broken and a good hard trail. What you always did was call up a phone and see if there were any trains on the track that day. Well, Luke called and there wasn't anything. And so they set out and they got up and got through the tunnel at mile 12. And, you know, there's a big canyon there on either side. And they got out of the tunnel, and whoo, here come a train.
Holy smoke.
And they'd been told that there wasn't any. Well, this was a yard engine is what it was, coming back from taking the train over the hump. And they didn't tell him about this. And here come this engine, and that old leader just stood there with his mouth open for a minute, Luke said. And then he took up over the side. And you know when a snow plow comes along, the snow is
really
6-8 feet high on either side of that railroad track. Well, the old dog clawed his way up there, and he tore out some of his nails doing it because it left bloody tracks in the snow, Luke said. Well, he tore up over the side of there, and Luke took the sled bodily and boosted it up and threw it over, and the man that was in the sled had jumped out and thrown over his two suitcases over on top. And down on the other side was a big canyon. The whole push of them rolled down in the canyon to the bottom of the canyon.
Mm-hmm.
But they'd saved themselves from the train.
Holy smokes.
The train never could have stopped because it came around this curve, you know. And
yeah. Well, so, what a faithful dog.
Yeah, so Luke figured the dog had saved our life twice.
Whatever happened to rats?
Well, we kept him until he died. He got so old, he finally passed on.
Yeah. How many years do you think you had him?
Oh, let me see. Well, I told you we lived 16 years at Seward, and he died before we left Seward.
Mm-hmm.
So he couldn't have been that old, I don't think.
No, I don't think a dog. Well, they'll live up to maybe 14
years
or so.
Yeah. But we didn't have him when we first came.
Yeah.
We didn't have him until after we went up to the mining camps.
Yeah. I guess you wouldn't be here today if it weren't for
no,
rats.
No, I wouldn't.
Yeah. He found a good home, two people who loved animals.
Yes. Yeah.
Did he ever change his attitude toward women?
He never did.
He never did.
No, sir. I never could handle that dog without letting him know I was boss.
Yeah.
Well, that was just one of his characteristics. And well, I loved him anyway.
To get back to Seward in 1920, you went there in 1920, And in 1923, President Harding came to Alaska. Do you recall when he came through Seward?
Because
didn't he have to come to Seward and then take the train?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was a big celebration. And they there weren't very many cars in Seward then. But they took him in a car and took him for a drive out to, I think, to mile 7. I think there was only 7 miles of roadway then, if I remember right. And they took him out there to see the country. And all along the way, they had guards stationed. And I don't know whether they were traffic cops or what they were for, but anyway, they had guards stationed along the road. And they had Luke out by the sawmill. He was stationed out there. And he had on his guide shirt, you know, a big black and red plaid or something like that. And when the president's car came along, he stopped and talked to him, shook hands with him, and took hold of the shirt and said, "My, that's a nice shirt. I wish I could wear a shirt like that." So Harding was real friendly with people and made quite a big hit in Seward when he was there.
And was he there overnight or just...
No. No, the train went on.
Train went on?
They just had the celebration in the morning and then the train went on.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember they made speeches off of the back of the observation car. Hoover, Herbert Hoover made a speech, and the president made a speech.
Do you recall who was the mayor of Seward then, or did you have a mayor?
I don't think we had a mayor in those days.
Mm-hmm. Was Saul Urey living in Seward in those days?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was. Do you know Saul?
I don't know him. Acquaintance with him is through the Pioneers.
Yes.
I see him every year at the Pioneer Convention.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I know his daughter, Lee McInerney.
Yeah.
Who's the mayor of Seward.
Well, I think he's in Kodiak now, isn't
he's
he?
He's moved to Kodiak.
Yes.
He's there with his
uh-huh.
son.
Yeah, he was there when we first came. They had a cable office over at the head of the bay out of Seward.
Was he in the Signal Corps?
Yes, he was.
Army Signal Corps?
That's right.
Yeah, because I know he was at Fort Lipscomb, out at Valdez, at one time.
Uh-huh.
But then when President Harding came up and went to Nenana for this ceremony where they drove the Golden Spike, did he come back then by railroad to Seward, or did he return to the States back through Seward?
Yes, had to.
Yeah,
that was the only way to get back. No airplanes then.
Unless they went over the Valdez Trail, that would take days and days and days.
Well, I don't think the Valdez Trail was there then, was it?
1920? Must have been some kind of a stage line. But there wouldn't have been in 1923. Let's see.
I can't recall.
Well, I know there were trucks running up and down there in the summer times. The road was pretty bad. I wouldn't recommend the trip for it.
No, I'm sure they came.
Time.
I'm sure they came back by train.
Yeah, right.
And went on the steamer.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a man I met in Juneau. I was surprised that he's still living. Governor Parks.
Oh, is he still living?
He was. I visited with him in April, and he was governor from 1925 to 1933. And I asked him if he had gone to if he were in Nenana at the time of the president visited and drove the Golden Spike, and he said very casually, "Well, as a matter of fact, I went to Tacoma and met the presidential party and traveled with them all the way and then returned outside with him."
Yeah.
At that time, Governor Parks was the chief Department of Interior man for Alaska.
Mm.
And so I very, you know, innocently wondered if he were there witnessing it. And he was the top Department of Interior man, which was kind of a top post for Alaska.
That's right.
In those days. And accompanied him the entire trip and then back out to Tacoma by ship. And yes, Governor Parks is living in the McKinnon Apartments in Juneau now.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
91 now, I think. And he's not getting around very much. His legs have kind of given out on him, but he's certainly interesting, and he's certainly got a good memory.
Yes.
And it's peculiar that most people, right, even right there in Juneau, don't know that he's still living.
No.
He just doesn't get out. Very much.
Well, I'm surprised to hear that he's still living.
And he was He told me, I think he came in 1907 or 1908. Been very much a part of Alaska.
Oh, yeah.
He and his crew, he was the head of the survey crew that laid out this town of Anchorage.
Huh.
And some of the early maps of Anchorage, the survey plans.
Is that right?
George Parks. Yeah.
See, I ran into a funny coincidence in Mexico. Pardon me. When I was down there, our landlord was quite a gardener. Oh, he planted a beautiful patio. We used to look down on it from our balconies. And I read in the paper that there was going to be a flower book on Mexican flowers, that they were hoping that it would be on the market for the Christmas down there. And gave the name of the woman who was writing it. Well, I watched and watched, and I didn't see it anywhere in the stores. So I finally wrote to this woman, she lived over in Mexico City, and asked her if the book was going to be on the market for Christmas. If it wasn't, would it be possible for me to get a copy? I wanted it from a landlord for Christmas. And she wrote back to me, and we got to writing, and I told her that I had sort of collaborated with Ada White Sharples on the first flower book about the Alaskan flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote back and told me, well, she had been a girl in Alaska. And she said she was in Anchorage when it was still part of it, a tent town. And that I think she said her father or her uncle had built the first frame building in Anchorage. And I suppose that's the club, you know, there's a building down there that's been there so long.
Oh, down by the Captain Cook.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And she said that she had even been on a prospecting trip with her uncle up the Susitna River one time, went along to cook for camp. And so we wrote back and forth, and she invited me to come and see her place if I ever came through Mexico City. And she was quite a famous person, and so was her husband. He is the artist who put all those murals on that library at the college.
Mm, yes.
You've seen pictures of that.
Oh, yes. I've seen it.
Diego or whatever his name is.
I was in Mexico City in 69.
That's a beautiful place.
Yes.
I saw it too. Well, anyway, he was an architect, you know, and he had built this house to fit the scenery. It was up in what they call the pedregal. It was all a big lava flow and all big lava rocks. And part of the house was back in the hill. And the rest of it was built so it just fit the scenery. Oh, it was a beautiful place. It's absolutely lovely.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you her name right now. I haven't got the memory that Governor Parks has. Names get away from me now.
Yeah, they certainly get away from me, too.
I have her name down in my address book there mm-hmm. somewhere. But yes, sir. And that was odd that she had been a girl in Alaska, and there she was married to a famous architect down in Mexico.
Oh, but had she lived here, or had she just come up and visited her uncles?
No, she'd evidently lived here.
Yeah. How many years did you go to Mexico? Several, or just one?
We went there three or four different winters.
Mm-hmm. Where did you stay, usually?
Well, when we first went down, we went all over the country to see the whole country. And most of the places were too high for my husband. He had heart trouble then. I didn't have it then. There was nothing wrong with me then.
Mm-hmm.
But we couldn't stay where it was too high because he couldn't get his breath. The air was too thin. So our friends had recommended a place which wasn't a tourist town since Liz and Burton had been there making this Night of the Iguana. It's turned into a big tourist town. It's a Puerto Vallarta. Puerto Vallarta.
Mm-hmm.
And it's right on the coast, and we went over there, and it agreed with Luke. So we went back there two other winters mm-hmm. after that.
Good.
And we have stayed up in Guadalajara. That's up rather high, though, but it's a lovely place to stay. And, I can't even remember the town. There's another town up the coast where we used to stay. Huh. I'll think of it pretty soon.
Guaymas?
Huh?
Guaymas?
No, not Guaymas. Further down.
It's been so many years since I've been down the coast. You know, I made a trip to Mexico City by train once. And the last time I was there was in 69. I went down there for a conference,
yes.
Newspaper woman's.
And we've
conference.
Been at La Paz, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's over on the, across the Gulf.
Well, tell me about your life now. Do you, are you active in anything here in Anchorage, or
no.
You stick pretty close to home?
Yes.
Yeah.
I belong to the World War I American Legion,
mm-hmm.
the auxiliary.
Mm-hmm. Do you belong to the Pioneers of Alaska?
No, I don't belong, and I never did belong. They've been at me for years to join. I never did belong because I never had a chance to go to the meetings.
Mm-hmm.
But some of my friends who are in the American Legion Auxiliary now say that they will get me an application, and so maybe I will join. Because now I have neighbors with whom I can go.
Yeah, well, that makes a difference.
And I never had a chance before to go to the meetings. No use belong if you don't ever get to go.
Well, since you and Luke lived out in the bush, I guess you'd call it, or
yeah.
the wilderness.
Out in the boondocks.
Boondocks, so much of your life. Did you ever have an automobile? I guess you did.
I haven't driven a car since I was a kid, and neither did Luke. And living up there in the woods, no roads, we had no use for a car, and Luke could fly. And he used to come in town sometimes, and he'd be out at the airport, and his friends, he'd say he had to go uptown. His friends say, "Here, take my car and go up." Luke would say, "I can't drive a car." "What? You can fly a plane, can't drive a car?" Which was true.
Yeah.
Well, when we lived in Yakima, we had what we called a bug. It was back in the days of the flivvers.
That was before you came to Alaska.
The Malays, yeah. Model A's and the Model T's, remember the old Fords?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had played, they called it auto polo with this car. They had the engine all souped up and they had a big frame up over the driver's seat, so when the cars rolled over, the driver wouldn't get killed. And they used to play polo with it. It really was exciting. We used to go to those auto polo games there at Yakima years ago. Well, this guy got hurt up and he had to sell his car. Luke bought it, and we took this frame off the top, you know, and we used to go clattering out all over all the cattle trails in the mountains going fishing with it.
Mm-hmm.
So Luke hadn't driven a car since that bug, and I hadn't driven a car since we had that. And although when I was young, my brother had a, what did we call it, a Rio, I think. There was a car in those early days called mm-hmm. a Rio. And let's see, there's another one. Oh, names get away from me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, neither one of us had driven a car since we were kids. So we never did get a car.
You never had one?
No.
Up here in
no,
Alaska?
Never had one.
Yeah. Did he ever have, was he ever forced to drive one?
No.
In any circumstances?
No.
Well, that's amazing. You've been here 54 years, and you've never driven a car in this state?
No. Nope.
That's quite unusual. Well, for a woman who's active as you and gotten out in the wilderness and hunted and mushed dogs, there are a lot of women who don't drive because they're the stay-at-home, timid type and just will never learn to drive. But that's unusual for a woman who's been as active as you. Well, I think you'd enjoy the Pioneers a lot if you
I would. Someone usually takes me to their picnics,
mm-hmm.
and I see a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I
go to try to go to the conventions every year because I like to talk to pioneers and like to. I just enjoy being around them.
Yes.
And the pioneer conventions are just a lot of fun,
mm-hmm.
just plain old fun.
Yeah.
And some people think that, well, oh, here come a bunch of old codgers to town. We got to be quiet.
Yeah.
Gosh, they're the noisiest, fun, most fun-loving
That's right.
conventioneers you ever could run across.
Yeah.
It's just great. It's really great. That's where I met this Saul Urey we talked about a little bit ago. Was it Pioneer Convention?
Yeah.
Well, I'd seen him many years ago when he was in Fairbanks. I remember he came into the News Miner when I worked there. For some reason, he was in Fairbanks. And I don't know when. I didn't join the Pioneers until 65, so I didn't. I've only been going to conventions for the last 5 or 6 years. Next year it's going to be in Nome. That'll be fun. Have you ever been in Nome?
No, I've never been there.
Did you or Luke ever go up into the Arctic or the Brooks Range to, with any
I've flown up there. Mm-hmm. I flown up through there in a Wigeon. Mm-hmm. And
did he ever guide in the Brooks Range?
No.
That's kind of a long ways away. If you have enough game down this way,
yes.
know the territory, know your own territory.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, that's a different country, all right, up there.
Yeah. I have a picture. I'll tell you about it first before I show it to you. A picture is taken up in the Brooks Range. I have it over here on my wall, and it's all that beautiful expanse of mountain country. And on a rock in the foreground is a big old raven sitting.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that picture, and I'll tell you why. When we were up on Birch Creek years ago, north of Chattanooga, I was watching one spring for the caribou herds come back with all their little calves on their northern migration. And I was laying out on a promontory with Luke's high-power binoculars, watching for the first animals to come over the far mountains. And I was laying there real still, and pretty soon here came a raven flying around over me. You know, quack, quack, quack. He thought I was dead.
Yeah.
And I didn't pay any attention to him, just kept on watching. Pretty soon he went away, and it wasn't long till they came back with four or five others. And they go, quack, 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 and they kept flying lower and lower over me. And I thought, well, they think I'm dead. And then I jumped up and gave him the horse laugh. And they just sounded disgusted when they flew away. I'll turn that off a minute and let me show you the picture.